Calder smiled. A good word for it. Karras laughed. Sir Bowden would be the first to admit it. Like the wolves, the Scars wear their barbarity as a mask. They pretend to be simple-minded reavers, when in reality, they are anything but. Speaking of pretense, look at these with your saboteur's eye and tell me what you see.
Calder gestured, and the projection changed, becoming a two-dimensional schematic of the cathedral palace. Lines of red and yellow formed, running up and down its length.
Yellow lines are transit conduits, and the red should not be there.
Karras frowned.
Secret passages? Hundreds of them.
Karras rubbed his chin.
Given the age and nature of this place, it is likely riddled with such things. What did Aemon say about them? That they didn't exist.
Karras looked at him.
He lied.
He gave it his best attempt,
Calder said.
He is hiding something. There are dead spaces on these maps. Secret routes, lift shafts. Escape routes?
Karras said. He sounded intrigued.
I do not think so.
Calder shook his head.
He is being evasive. It is infuriating. What do the records say?
Calder grunted.
They are encrypted. Break the encryption.
Calder looked at him. Karras shrugged.
If he is hiding something, then we should find out, don't you think?
Calder sighed.
I do not have time for mysteries, brother.
He shook his head.
Why can nothing ever be simple? Because the universe is not simple. It is made from manifold complexities, all pushing and pulling against one another in ways we can but dimly perceive.
Karras tapped a finger against Calder's shoulder plate.
My advice, don't try. Be ready, be wary, but do not let it consume you. If there is treachery afoot, it will be revealed in due time. And if not, then it was never worth concerning yourself about in the first place. Perhaps you're right. Of course I'm right. I am very good at this, as I said.
Karras scratched his chin.
Hightown is easily sealed off. The main thoroughfares are wide and readily defensible from air and ground assault. Lowtown is the issue. And if they take Lowtown, they threaten the foundations of the upper city.
Karras blinked owlishly.
You think they'll try to bring it down? I would. Take the low, shatter the high. Mop up what's left.
Karras looked at him.
Destructive. Efficient, Calder said. But if conquest is their aim, they'll use the foundations to move upwards. They'll take the causeways, the aeroports and landing pads, moving upwards wherever they meet the least resistance. We currently lack the manpower to defend the entirety of Lowtown.
He looked at Karras.
Suggestions?
Karras was silent for a moment.
You have not taken into account our greatest resource, the population. Arming the population is not feasible. They lack training and discipline. Most will flee or hide. But there are those among them who will not.
Calder paused.
You mean the criminal gangs?
Lowtown was rife with crime. The gangs varied in size from a few individuals to more complex organizations focused on inter-system smuggling or extortion. He had a compilation of the most recent reports on such activity, but had determined them to be low priority.
They may lack the discipline, but they'll have a form of training and an existing network to exploit. The guilds, as well as laborers, dockyards, the etherport, all have some form of organization you can take advantage of.
Karras brought up the files and illuminated grid sections on the map.
Look, here. Lowtown has over 30 major criminal operations under observation, and each of them probably has the equivalent of a private army, willing and able to carry a weapon.
Calder nodded.
A solid plan, brother. I will need to speak to the planetary magistrate at once.
He routed a coded vox pulse to one of the private ether craft that Aemon had put at their disposal. A responding ping told him that the ship would be waiting for him in the nearest landing bay. He paused and then glanced at Karras.
Do you wish to accompany me?
Kara smiled.
I thought you'd never ask.
Rukan leaned back and scraped the edge of his knife down the branch, stripping off the bark. He sat on a flat stone, overlooking the Saint's Rest, a wide expanse of hard-packed, blackened earth, flattened over the centuries by thousands of landing craft. Trees hugged the edge of the expanse, and among them lay the hab units and guidance towers of a tertiary landing zone. A single suborbital telemetry array lurked to the north, angled towards the stars. Rukan's bare arms were sinewy maps of scar tissue, and his face bore the traces of shrapnel and blade wounds. Three pale ritual slashes marked one tanned cheek, a sign of his ascension to manhood many centuries past. He wore a warrior's topknot, and his thick beard was bound into a single plait, held together by intricately carved bone rings. He sniffed the wind as he sliced away another strip of bark. The air was thin here and cold. The mountain peaks rose so high that they seemed almost to scrape the underbelly of the stars. A paved road, bordered by solid causeways, led down through the crags and into the valleys below. It reminded him of home, but only a bit. Jugoris was a flat world for the most part, and the mountains distant. But Almes was a world of curves and slopes. The system had extensive asteroid fields, and most of the worlds in it had suffered from meteor impacts within the last millennia. Now, forests spread across the impact sites, flourishing due to the lakes that filled the craters. Between these craters and the mountains thrown up by their creation, the world was tumultuous and rocky. The mountains were the only place where ships of any size could safely make an orbital descent, and so he and his students had come. A dozen Space Marine scouts, clad in the white of the chapter, moved swiftly about the landing zone, hard at their trade. To a man, their hair was unbound, or cropped short, as was the tradition. Only a proven warrior could wear a topknot. They carried a variety of weapons, for Rukan believed a warrior should be prepared for any eventuality. Several sunk sensor triggers into the hard earth and planted crack and frag mines at carefully calculated intervals. Others strung monofilament wire through the buildings overlooking the landing zone, or erected deadfalls and drop pits. Rukan oversaw their efforts, doling out the occasional grunt of satisfaction or dismissal. This was the third potential landing zone they had prepared for the enemy. Of the initial 15 the Imperial Fists had identified, 5 had been targeted for destruction. The remaining 10 had been split between the warriors of the White Scars, the Raven Guard, and the Imperial Fists. Each chapter would prepare the areas in their own way. Those closest to Almacia were being fortified and garrisoned. The ones further out were being rigged with traps and automated defensive emplacements. Rukan was not privy to the overall strategy at work, but he thought he'd guessed it well enough. The Imperial Fists had a good head for such things. The areas Cowder had identified corresponded closely with Rukan's own assessment of the planet. There were few places anything of any size, such as troop carriers, could land safely. Not without pounding the area flat first. And even then, moving equipment and men across such terrain would take time. Two, the enemy had shown a willingness, a preference even, to capitalize on existing landing zones. That made sense. Making use of an enemy's infrastructure was an old trick, and one Space Marines often used to great effect. It allowed for swift deployment, despite the obvious dangers. If you were canny, you could turn a planet's substructure into a weapon. Paths could be diverted or booby-trapped. Landing zones used to coordinate flak batteries and vox grids given over to false encryptions. That was what they were doing here, and all across the world, giving their foes a trickster's path to walk. Many options, all of them bad. But such preparations required time, something Rukan sensed that they did not have much of. They would do what they could in what was available, but it wouldn't be enough. The enemy would land troops, and then it would be a fight. The vox bead in his ear clicked. Rukan looked over at one of his charges, crouched near the tree line. The scout gestured.
There's a depression here, a perfect place to set up one of those automated guns the Imperial Fists gave us.
The guns were stripped-down assault cannons with a dual drum feed, mounted on anchored plinths. Their machine spirits were primitive, even by the standards of remote weapons. They would fire until their drums ran dry, and then power down. They weren't built for punishment the way a thunderfire cannon was, but they performed their duty well enough. The White Scar studied the landing zone with a hunter's eye, marking the places where multiple gunships might touch down. There was always a pattern to it. The winds were high here, and they would be under fire from automated flak batteries. He paused, calculating. He gestured with his branch.
No, there, to your left. Great Point Tertius Quintus. Set it up there.
The scout didn't argue.
Pressure plate or motion sensor? Motion sensor with time sequence, Rucken said. We don't want it firing until they've started to disembark.
The scout nodded and set about the task with commendable diligence. Rucken watched them work, wondering, as he often did these days, whether they were the last such warriors he would ever train. The galaxy was changing around him in ways he couldn't fathom. He thought of the Imperial Fist, Calder, the way he and his intercessors towered over others, the way they moved with a grace that even space marines could not match. Their kind were on Jagoras now, learning the ways of the Brotherhoods. The thought unsettled him. Many of these Primaris were not from Jagoras. They were Terran, from the days before the Great Khan had lost himself to legend. They did not even speak Korchin. Yet, they had been welcomed into the chapter's ranks. They were needed. Every blade had value, whatever shape or origin. Or so he'd been taught. He remembered his first glimpse of those new brothers. So like those he knew, and yet not. At first, he'd thought them machines or mutants. How else to explain such dissimilar similarity? They even smelled different. Was this how humans felt when they met his kind? If so, he could understand their hesitation. It was as if the future were a hungry wolf, pacing just beyond the fire's light. Eventually, it would come for Rucken and those he called brother. Only time would tell whether they would survive, whether they would continue, or whether they would fade from the galaxy, as the ancient Thunder Warriors had, in the days of Terra's unification. As he considered this, the snarl of the Vox pulled from his reverie.
Rucken, are you there, old wolf?
The voice was that of Torag, the Aquilian, the master of the Fifth Company's air support. Rucken sighed.
I'm here, Aquilian. At least someone is. I half feared Sabaudin would leave me here with nothing but ravens and laborers for company. Is that any way to speak of our allies? Do I speak false?
Rucken laughed.
No, birds and builders they are. I wonder what they say of us. They are likely too much in awe to say much,
Torag said. The Aquilian was arrogant in the way of all birds of prey. Too much time hunting the skies had given him an inflated notion of his own prowess. Rucken remembered when Torag had been one of his, before the Aquilian had earned the right to wear a warrior's topknot. Torag had been taciturn then, and inattentive. He sighed.
Yes, I am sure that is so. What do you want, Aquilian? I've completed the destruction of the last of the landing zones in the northwestern grid. I wanted to see whether you required assistance.
Rucken frowned.
You're no better at lying now than you were as a scout, Aquilian.
The Vox crackled for a moment. Rucken could imagine the Aquilian's face as he tried to decide whether or not to argue the point. In the end, Torag grunted sourly.
What are we doing here, old wolf?
Rucken knew the question was rhetorical. He decided to annoy Torag by answering it as if it weren't.
Once I rode with the master of the hunt himself, Aquilian, as did you. Then we chose to join Sabaudin's Minghan when he went to Armageddon. And we stayed with him when he left. And now we are here. A bad decision in retrospect,
Rucken snorted.
You sound upset.
I am upset, brother.
Oh, would you like to discuss it?
Don't patronize me, old wolf.
Rocken snorted.
You're angry, then, aren't you?
Static crackled for a moment.
We shall be with the Khan, not here.
It is up to the Khan to choose where we should be.
He made the wrong choice.
Be sure to tell him that the next time you see him.
You know what I mean, brother. Why are we here? The Raven Guard could complete these preparations as easily as we can. Why waste our skills here when we could be out there hunting the foe?
Why waste time hunting the foe when the foe is coming here?
Why let them come here at all when we could paint the stars with their blood?
Careful, brother. Someone might accuse you of being poetic.
Torak laughed, a harsh sound, like the croak of some great bird of prey.
Surely you feel the same way, Rakan.
Even if I did, I have my orders, as do you. We stand with the Imperial Fists and the Raven Guard, under Lieutenant Calder's command.
He is no Imperial Fist.
Rakan ceased his whittling and sighed.
He wears their colors. He espouses their way of war. He venerates their Primarch. What would you call him?
Unnatural.
Your biases are showing, Aquilian,
Rakan said. Torag, like many, shared his concerns and was more willing to voice them, regardless of who might be listening.
Just because you're short,
Torag growled, and the vox signal twitched like a thing alive.
Do not mock me, old wolf! You know damn well what I mean. He is Primaris. He is not like us.
That is true. He is taller, and his insides are more crowded. But beyond that, we are the same.
Rakan bent back to his whittling. He considered sharing his own unease, but Torag had irritated him. Torag had always irritated him, even as a scout.
It is not seemly that he be sent over us, merely because he is...
What? Who would you have had the Khan put in charge? He would not thank you for that, brother. We would still be doing as we are now, and more of us besides. At least this way, some among our brotherhood taste battle.
Rakan chuckled.
Be generous of spirit, brother.
You're one to talk.
One of us must be sensible.
Torag growled, a low rumble of discontent. Insulted, perhaps, he deactivated his vox, leaving the conversation unfinished. Rakan waited a few moments to see if the Aquilian would return, and then turned back to his duties. The problem with his brothers, by and large, was that they prized foolish things. What was honour next to victory? What was glory next to survival? Rakan had never seen the point of such ephemeral desires. To be, to serve, was enough for him. To do what he was good at, and be allowed to do it well, was all he had ever desired. Sabodan Khan, at least, understood that, and had allowed him to remain as a teacher for the younger warriors, and those who had yet to earn their scars and scalp locks. He sighed again, and turned his attentions back to his students. He stabbed his sharpened stick into the ground and stood, loosing an annoyed grunt.
Not there, fools!
He roared, as abashed scouts turned, dismayed expressions on their faces.
Consider the angles of fire! Recalculate and reposition those guns! Hurry now!
Rakan looked up. Somewhere above, the Khan was riding into battle. For a moment, Rakan wished he was with Sabodan and the others. He laughed to himself and tugged on his beard. The enemy would be here soon enough. He merely had to be patient. The precinct fortress sat on the edge of the mid-city, guarding the boundary between high and low. Midtown was a narrow stretch of high-end hab units and shopfronts, a twilight space between the rich and the poor. Here, the well-to-do could slum without actually going to the slums, and the poor could pretend to be rich, if only for a few moments. Karos had seen many such places in his centuries of war.
A lie,
he murmured, as the grav train descended into the stew of narrow streets. The tram was one of Aemon's personal transports, marked with his sigil. It was meant to carry the emissaries of the Cardinal Governor and their bodyguards into the lower areas of the city, to conduct the business of state. The grav unit set into its undercarriage hummed loudly, straining against the weight of its current passengers, even as the archaic chassis rattled about them.
What?
Carros recalled that the Voxlink was open.
This place, it is a lie.
Calder glanced at him.
I was not aware a place could be a lie.
He stood near the doors, arms crossed. His head was bent slightly to keep from damaging the bottom of the roof. Benches lined the sides of the cab, and the windows were of hardened glass. Through the windows, Carros could see other grav trams, smaller and less powerful than the one they were in, travelling slowly between the tiers of the city. There were more primitive forms of transport visible as well. Communal transit platforms carrying hundreds of people rose and fell at designated shaft points, their machinery spewing oily smoke and sparks. There were also large stone stairways for the thousands of pedestrians to move along quieter routes.
A figure of speech. I'm aware, Calder said.
Carros heard the smile in his words.
Forgive me, brother. I'm not used to one of you having a sense of humour. An Imperial Fist? Or a Primaris? Both. Either.
Carros looked down. His auto-senses detected a faint tremor in the engines. The tram was old, and like so much in the Imperium, coming apart at the joins. He wondered if it could be fixed. Then he wondered if it should be fixed. Carros often found himself wondering about such things. It was a failing, he knew. Doubt was a flaw in the armour of the soul, but nonetheless he doubted. He wondered even about the simplest of things. Some among his chapter thought that made him overcautious. They thought his doubt made him hesitant to commit to a strategy. He often found himself subordinated to others, always second, never first, always the shadow, never the caster. That suited him.
Why a lie?
He looked up. Calder was watching him. The Imperial Fist was unsettlingly observant at times.
Better to say it is an illusion, a mask that people can slip on, to pretend to be something else, and when they ascend or descend, the truth is revealed. Places like this are playgrounds of falsehood. They hide the sins of the wealthy and conceal the degradation of the poor. You sound as if you have made a study of such a place. Haven't you?
Carros tapped on the window, tracing shapes in the condensation that collected in the corners.
You seek to emphasize strength. I look to the flaws. Exacerbate the resentment of the lowest, and you can cripple a city. The Raven Guard wage little wars to win big ones.
He rubbed a thumb and finger together, letting his armor's tactile senses examine the condensation.
I could take this city with 5 warriors, maybe 10. And if I were guarding it?
He'd expected the question, anticipated it, but not the tone. There was no anger in it, no implied chastisement, only curiosity. He paused, but only for a moment.
20. Maybe double that if you'd had time to prepare the defences.
Calder nodded.
I estimated 15.
Carros wasn't sure if that was a compliment or merely a statement of fact. Before he could reply, the grav tram's landing klaxon gave a whoop. The tram shuddered as it settled onto a designated plinth beneath the watchful gazes of stony saints and angels. The doors jutted open with a hiss, and a metal walkway clattered down. Calder ducked beneath the frame and stepped out onto the street. Carros followed, scanning their surroundings. If someone was planning to attempt an assassination, now would be an ideal moment. As he stepped down onto the pavement, he blink-activated a dull rune on his helm display. A dizzying array of images flashed into view, crowding at the edges of his vision. His warriors had set up thousands of picked recorders throughout the city in order to assemble a working tactical map for Calder. A rune flashed, alerting him to a stray Vox signal. Someone was talking on an encrypted channel close by. Innocuous enough in a city, but then perhaps not. Through the feed, he watched as men and women slunk into view. He watched them watch him and Cowder walk along the avenue. It was somewhat disconcerting to see himself from above.
"We're being watched," he said.
Around them, people drew back. Karras's battle plate registered spikes in adrenaline in the closest. Fear. Fight or flight. Those were the reactions the Adeptus Astartes provoked in those unused to their presence. Familiarity allowed a normal human to pretend that a space marine was just like them, but for the differences in height and mass. But in the back of their mind was always that first terrible impression. Here be monsters.
"Yes."
Cowder's head twitched, and Karros knew he was studying the feed as well.
"Not just by human eyes."
Karros glanced up and saw the distinctive fetal shape of a cyber cherub flitting across the gap between two buildings. He'd amused himself their first night on Almace by capturing several of the cyber cherubs and backtracing their pick streams. Two had led him to members of the Ecumenical Council. The third had belonged to Aemon. Spies were common among the upper classes of the Imperium. Everyone who could afford them had several. The Ecclesiarchy was no different. Mostly, the spies watched each other. But the arrival of space marines was often akin to a stone dropped into still waters. Every action made ripples. He knew Calder could feel it as well. Tension was increasing by the day, and the number of spies was growing. These were just the ones they'd noticed. As if reading his thoughts, Calder said,
"It was worse on Terra. Every two-bit bureaucrat has their own spy network. They practically trip over each other in their hurry to report to their masters. You'd think we were the invaders."
"We are,"
Calder said.
"We just happen to be the ones on their side. The Precinct Fortress is just ahead."
Kara spotted it as soon as Calder spoke. A forbidding structure of flat, sharp angles, studded with weaponry. The Precinct Fortress was meant to be a command center and bastion in the event of civil upheaval or an invasion, and was built to survive anything up to a direct orbital strike. Irregular bulwarks of ferrocrete blocked direct street access to the outer walls, and there were no buildings within a block. Enforcers patrolled the bulwarks, accompanied by cyber mastiffs. The heavy adamantine gates groaned as they slid open, allowing Calder and Karros to enter the precinct courtyard. Enforcers and administratum clerks watched them warily as they crossed the yard.
"They do not seem pleased to see us,"
Karros murmured.
"Why should they be? Our presence is a sign that something has, or is about to go, badly wrong for someone. They are probably hoping it is not them."
The entry hall was akin to a cathedral in size and shape, with armoured windows of hardened glass lining the upper reaches and tall support pillars stretching back from the main gate to the internal portcullis. A pair of riot servitors stalked along the line of pillars on jointed insect legs of steel, their rotor cannons tracing the two space marines, their organic components hidden behind layers of armour plating. The walls of the entry hall were unadorned, save for the inspirational quotations carved in large letters every few yards. Mortals scattered before them, finding other places they urgently needed to be. Klaxons sounded somewhere, deep in the fortress, and voxcasters crackled at every archway, alerting the enforcers to crimes in progress or civil unrest in Lowtown. There were at least 1,000 enforcers on duty at any given time in Almacia, with another 300, mostly retired, standing by on reserve. No one sought to stop them as they made their way across the hall.
"Someone told them we were coming,"
Calder said across the voxlink.
"Hard to hide our approach,"
Karras replied. His armour detected more than 100 different sensors scanning them. Like the rest of Almacia, the Precinct Fortress was a mixture of functional and obsolete. He watched one of the riot servitors settle onto its sextet of haunches, weapons powering down.
"Have you spoken to the magistrate yet?"
"Not since the welcoming feast, and then only briefly."
Karros grunted.
"Have you thought about how you'll approach this matter?"
"Directly and politely."
"I wasn't aware Imperial Fist knew the meaning of the word polite."
"We know it. We simply ignore it most of the time."
They came to a set of wide steps, stretching from one side of the hall to the other. The steps rose upwards at a steep angle and were occupied by hundreds of clerks and civilians, all moving quickly in different directions. As the first of them caught sight of the two space marines, the crowd began to part, allowing Calder and Karos to ascend unhindered. At the top of the steps, a phalanx of enforcers awaited them, arrayed protectively about their magistrate. The woman cleared her throat loudly as Calder came to a halt before them. The mortals were armed, but wisely kept their weapons aimed elsewhere.
"Magistrate Gil," Calder said in greeting.
Magistrate Gil was a narrow, austere woman of indeterminate age. Her uniform was clean and pressed, her buttons and boots shiny, but the carapace armour she wore had seen much use, and there were fleshette scars on her face.
"My lord," she said, "I was told you were coming, but I did not expect you so soon."
Despite her words, her tone betrayed little of the nervousness Karos had come to expect. Likely, her agents had warned her of their arrival. Why else meet them here, with armed guards and in the open? There were more strings of influence in a city such as this than either he or Calder could pluck in a lifetime. Calder did not acknowledge her pretense.
"I doubt that," he said.
Karos nodded approvingly. If she wished to play the flustered bureaucrat, she was free to do so. It made no difference to their objectives. Calder reached up and removed his helm, letting her see his face.
"I will make this brief. We both have other duties. There are 15 major criminal syndicates active in this system, not counting the pirate bands that haunt the Rimwood Stars. I want the leaders of the 5 largest organizations brought to me within 12 hours.
Gil blanched.
"I can't do that, my lord. That's beyond our capabilities.
He cut her off.
"You are accepting protection ties from at least 3 by my calculations. Comparisons of summary judgments, arrest reports and witness statements make for solid circumstantial evidence."
Karos blinked in some surprise. Calder had indeed done his research. The Imperial Fist fixed the magistrate with his gaze.
"Your heart rate is elevated, and I can smell fear in your sweat."
He smiled.
"There is no need to be frightened. I am not in the habit of wasting valuable resources when they can still be of use."
Gil swallowed and looked around. Karos judged that she was holding on to her composure by her fingernails.
"They won't come willingly, even if you promise safe conduct."
The excuse was weak. Given the look on her face, even she knew it.
"I did not specify that they should come willingly, only that they be brought before me. How they arrive is up to you."
Calder paused.
"Living is preferable."
"Why?"
She paled, even as the word left her mouth. Calder was silent for a moment. Then,
"A city is only as strong as its weakest point. Criminals are a weak point. In times of societal stress, they will seek their own advantage. I wish to convince them that that advantage lies with me, rather than the enemy. Bring them to me in 12 hours, or I will find them myself."
Gil shuddered slightly.
"As you command, my lord."
Calder nodded and pulled his helmet back on.
"My thanks, magistrate. I will allow you to return to your duties now."
He turned away and started down the steps. Karos waited a moment, studying the enforcers until they began to shift nervously, before following. As they left, Karos nodded approvingly.
"Very direct. Not very polite, though." "Really? I thought I was. She is still alive, after all."
Karos laughed. Chapter 9 40005 Pergamon, Secundus Grey Tithe World. Amatnim sat back on the broken plinth. Books and data slates were stacked untidily beside him, and as he finished perusing each in turn, he tossed it into the waiting fires nearby. He was studying a book of liturgical reminiscences from the 38th millennium when he caught sight of Lacamhue, stalking towards him. The Dark Apostle roughly shoved past the guards Apis had stationed at the entrance to the forum, where the purge was being conducted.
"Come to join the good work, brother?"
Amatnam called out, without looking up from his reading. He licked his thumb and turned the crackling pages. The tight, spidery script was written in a dialect of High Gothic that had been archaic before the end of the Great Crusade. Carefully, he tore out a page, crumpled it, and tossed it into the fire.
"Why not simply set the shelves or this entire structure on fire?"
Lakimhu demanded. Amatnam sighed and flicked the book into the greedy flames. He rose to his feet.
"For the same reason we didn't burn the planet from orbit."
Amatnam picked up another book and began to flip through it.
"How many pyramids of skulls did you build, then? Do we have any slaves left?"
"The answer to both questions is enough,"
Lakimhu said flatly. He looked around.
"Some escaped."
"Yes, I expect that they did."
Amatnam frowned. The orbital dockyards had proven more difficult to take than he'd anticipated. Dozens of vessels, trading ships mostly, had escaped the attack, their headings unknown, but easy to guess.
"We'll catch them."
"Will we?"
"Someone will."
Amatnam picked up another book and began to strip it of pages.
"We have hunters aplenty still in orbit, or prowling the trade lanes. And we will have more soon enough, once word gets to the rim."
"And then what?"
Before Amatnam could reply, a hunched slave scuttled over. Scaly features split in an ingratiating expression. It burbled something in the broken tongue of its kind, and Amatnam smiled paternally.
"Apis sent you? Has he found it, then?"
The creature nodded so fiercely, its whole body shook. Amatnam tossed the book he was holding over his shoulder.
"Excellent. Take me to him."
"Take you to what?"
Lakimhu demanded.
"Did you not hear what I said?"
"Yes, I am simply unconcerned. They always escape. Tides of refugees roll ahead of us against the rock of Almes, taking tales of our power with them."
Amatnam started after the slave as it scurried away, moving in a peculiar serpentine fashion.
"We know where they are going, and we want them to go there."
Lakimhu followed him.
It would better serve us to offer them up here." The Neverborn pressed close, murmuring for the blood of the unworthy.
"And? A few days more or less will not harm their appetites."
"The gods?"
"The gods put me in charge, brother. Remember?"
Amatnam didn't turn, but he could feel displeasure radiating from the Dark Apostle.
"How long did those you summoned earlier last? A few hours? Less?
The Neverborn, for all their divine glory, are but brief things, seeking their own satiation above all else, especially on worlds like these, saturated in the false faith of the corpse worshippers."
"As are we at times, brother,"
Lakimhu said pointedly. Amatnam laughed.
"Yes, but unlike a Neverborn, I won't fade from reality when my belly is full. Let them wait, Lakimhu. Once we reach Almes, we shall cast 1,001 souls into the great river and draw them to the surface. But not here. Not now."
"You would deny the gods?"
"I deny them every day, and twice on holy days."
Lakimhu studied him silently.
Was that supposed to be a joke?
"What do you think?"
"I think you went mad at some point, brother, and we didn't notice, else you would not speak such blasphemies."
Amatnam laughed.
"Perhaps. And if I am mad, then the universe is mad with me. Foresee how it unfolds itself to grant me passage. The drawbridge of Castle Perilous lowers, and the Sangreal beckons."
"What?"
Amatnam glanced at him. "Myths and legends, brother. Just myths and legends.
But without them, what is faith, save hollow dogma? What are we, save mechanisms of meat and instinct?
There must be something greater, else we are less than we imagine ourselves to be."
"You have an alarming tendency to spout gibberish when you're excited,"
Lakimhu said sourly. Amatnim ignored the jibe. The slave had led them to the causeway. The great door was a twisted, blackened ruin now, after almost 10 hours of effort. Apis had led hunter-killer teams into the network of corridors and access tunnels beyond, in order to run down the last of the enemy garrison. Similar efforts were underway throughout the city, as Amatnim's followers finished off the last of Pergamon's defenders with bloody efficiency. The Lord Deacon had been found dead, slain by his own guards, likely to prevent him from capitulating. The commander of the planet's armies had died soon after, in an attempt to break through the word-bearer's lines. Dusep had sent Amatnim the man's head as a token of respect. Apis was waiting for him on the other side of the gate. His battle plate was streaked with soot and gore, and he held his helm under one arm. He nodded to Amatnim and ignored Lacamhue.
"We've found it, my lord. It took almost 10 sweeps, but we've located it at last."
"Excellent. You haven't approached it, then?"
Apis grimaced.
"Couldn't, until now. Moment we got close, we activated concealed defense alcoves. They were sensor-numbed. Not even heat leakage to give them away. They contained a pair of battle servitors."
He leaned over and spat a gobbet of acidic spittle on the ground.
"Like nothing I've encountered outside of a Mechanicum facility."
"How many casualties?"
"Mervo and Cheyenne from my own host, and that bastard Kararites from the Red Star Brotherhood."
Apis frowned.
"We also lost nearly 30 of our bondsmen. Those things sighed through them like it was harvest season."
Lacamhue laughed.
"Perhaps if you'd waited for aid..."
Apis looked at him but said nothing. Amatnim clapped his subordinate on the shoulder.
"It's of no importance, brother. The task is accomplished. That is all that matters. Lead the way.
I'm eager to see our prize."
Apis dismissed the slave with a gesture and led them across the causeway into the central bastion of the library. Everywhere were signs of hard fighting, shattered bulwarks and scorch marks on the walls. Spent shell casings covered the marble floors, and the bodies, too many to count, all of them mortal. If there was one thing the word-bearers had learned in their exile, it was how to let the mortals absorb the bulk of the enemy's fire. The cultists were often only too happy to do so. Death in service to the Legion was a glorious thing.
"Fewer of the enemy than I thought,"
Lacamhue said as he stepped over a corpse clad in grey battle plate. She had died hard, and the broken bodies of her killers rested around her.
"I did warn you," Amatnim said. "They fight like Khorne's own."
Lacamhue grunted.
"Speaking of which, listen. They clamour at the threshold."
Amatnim had heard it as well. The harsh panting of unseen beasts. The scrape of brass claws against the walls of time. If he turned his head just right, he could almost make them out, hunched and eager. They whispered to him in harsh sibilance, demanding release. He stopped, sighed, and glanced at Apis.
"Are there still foes aboard, brother? Or have you killed them all?"
Apis frowned.
"There might be a few."
"Good enough."
Amatnim looked at Lacamhue and gestured resignedly.
"Go ahead, brother. Wouldn't want to disappoint them, would we? If we do, they might not answer us when we actually need them."
Lacamhue smiled and spoke a single word, not one meant for a human throat, but somehow he managed. It echoed on the air like the peal of a bell. The smell of blood intensified, a sour, coppery odour that quickly grew overwhelming. Nearby bodies twitched and jerked, as if being worried by unseen dogs. The sounds of claws, of brutal whispers, grew louder and louder. Red smoke boiled upwards from the battle-torn bodies, congealing into gangling, lanky shapes. Not human, but something closer to a violent act given form. More than a dozen skull faces, the colour of clotted blood, had formed, shuddering with vicious need, snapping wildly at the air with teeth like brass shrapnel.
"Khorne's huntsman," Apis breathed.
Amatnim nodded. Blood letters. The demons twitched at the name of their lord and swung hideous faces towards him. One took a step, raising the great, steaming blade it held. Amatnim stepped forward, extending his palm. The sigil of binding was still etched there, and the demon twisted away, hissing.
"Jerk their leashes, Lacamhew, or I'll do it for you," Amatnim said. "Now!"
Lacamhew carved a sigil on the air with his crozius, and the blood letters turned their ugly gazes on the dark apostle. He spoke to them in their own tongue, and Amatnim winced at the sound. Eight of the creatures crouched on their haunches like attentive hounds. The others scattered, loping down the nearest access tunnels and through bullet-scorched hatches, hunting their prey.
"They'd best keep their blades to themselves," Apis growled. "My warriors won't hesitate to send them back to the Blood God if they get rambunctious. They know the scent of their prey, never fear,"
Lacamhew said, looking down his nose at the other word-bearer.
"And if your warriors are stupid enough to raise a weapon against them, they deserve whatever fate awaits them."
"Enough, both of you. Apis, the vault, now."
Apis shook his head.
"My apologies, my lord. This way."
The vault sat at the bottom of a convoluted stairway. Blood stained the steps, and spent shell casings rolled away untidily as they descended. Bodies had been dragged into side passages, or simply kicked down the steps to the chamber at the bottom. The chamber was large and circular, lined with rounded pillars and alcoves. In the latter, plinth-mounted statues stood, staring down at the invaders.
"The servitors were disguised as statues," Apis said.
He motioned to an empty plinth.
"The first we knew of them, they were leaping down right on top of us."
The signs of that battle were everywhere. Torn bodies lay huddled in the corners, or scattered in pieces across the floor. The twisted, blackened remains of the two servitors were in the centre of the chamber, in a wide circle of ash. A word-bearer stood over them, a flamer cradled loosely in his hands. Two others stood sentry before a heavily reinforced doorway.
"Any sign of life?"
Apis said.
"Nothing," the word-bearer with the flamer said. "If they're in there, they're keeping quiet. We've already disabled the environmental controls and the oxygen circulators. It's probably quite stifling in there now." "Maybe they suffocated,"
one of the others said with a chuckle. His companion laughed.
"Maybe they killed each other in desperation. Wouldn't that be funny, Apis?" "No, Gurnt,"
Apis said.
"It wouldn't." "Well, I think it'd be funny,"
Gurnt said.
"Quiet,"
Apis said, as Amatnim stepped past him and went to the door. The vault was not of a kind he recognized. He suspected it was akin to a bunker, and that the library had been built around it. He leaned close, running his hands along the visible joins. There was no obvious way in. On the other side, probably. He tilted his head. There was a faint hum just audible on the vox.
"Ghost signal," he said.
He looked at Lacamhew and tapped the side of his helm.
"Hear it, brother? Someone is receiving vox messages in there."
"From where?"
Lacamhew asked.
"Let's find out."
Amatnim stepped back.
"Should we blow it open?"
Apis asked, running a hand along the door.
"I have the remaining melter charges handy. Might bring down the roof, though."
"No, there are easier ways. Look there, at the pillars."
Amatnim gestured.
"There are sensor nodes in every pillar. The locking system is automatic. They need someone to open the door from the outside."
"We probably should have taken prisoners," Gurnt said.
"No, they wouldn't trust such a task to someone who could be taken captive or killed so easily."
Amatnim kicked at the ash around the remains of the servitors for a moment and grunted.
"There we are, as I thought."
Lacamhew growled impatiently.
"Why are we here? What is in there that's so important?"
"Do you ever think about faith, brother?"
Amatnim said, as he sank to his haunches. He plucked the blackened skull free of the ashes and examined it. Wires hung from it, and strange devices, now warped by heat, clustered the skull like barnacles.
Constantly,
Lacombe said. Have you ever wondered if we're wrong? Amatnim stood, still clutching the skull. He looked at the Dark Apostle. Lacombe was staring at him in incomprehension. Finally, he said,
I have not.
No, I don't suppose you have. Amatnim paused. Neither have I come to that.
Oh, then why ask the question?
Someone must.
I was right, you are mad.
Faith unquestioned is a blade untested, Amatnim said. He extended the skull. They do not question. That is why they worship a corpse.
And we worship the Pantheon.
Yes, the four paths to the primordial truth. Amatnim pulled the skull to his chest and flicked ash from its crumbling crown. He held it gingerly, careful not to crush it, and continued to brush away ash until a metal barcode was revealed, set into the skull.
We follow all in moderation, and thus avoid truths becoming lies.
Even as the Urizen taught us.
And yet Erebus encourages some among our brothers to follow one god or the other, when it suits his purposes, as if offering their souls up in sacrifice.
Amatnim glanced slyly at Lacombe, watching to see if his jibe had struck home.
If they are not strong enough to wield the blade, then the stone is their fate,
Lacombe replied with pious certainty.
Yes, sometimes I wonder, though, will it ever be our turn to lay on that stone?
Only if we fail.
Amatnim held the skull up to the closest pillar. An unseen sensor blurted a code sequence. Scanning pulses danced across the skull, reading the barcode, as it would have done when the servitor had been functional. There was a hiss of escaping air, and hidden pneumatics groaned to life. Amatnim crushed the skull and cast the pieces aside as the great door began to open.
There we are. Come, brothers, let us see what there is to see.
Pressurized air jetted from unseen vents as the vault cracked wide. Amatnim waved the others forward and drew his sidearm. Gurnt was the first through, and as he stepped into the vault, a heavy weapon opened up, driving him back against the frame of the portal. He returned fire, his bolt gun roaring.
I count six hostiles, possibly more,
he spat as the others sought cover to either side of the opening. Impact craters opened on his battle plate, and he sank down, cursing.
I could use some help! Patience, brother, Apis said.
He plucked a frag grenade from his belt, but before he could throw it, Amatnim caught his wrist.
No, I don't want anything damaged. Lacombe, send in your hounds.
Lacombe gestured, and the bloodletters surged forward, through the doorway and into the vault. Screams and shouts followed. Amatnim stepped through as Apis dragged Gurn to his feet. The vault was not as massive as he'd assumed. Rather, it was a utilitarian space, crammed with scrivener plinths, where scribe servitors hunched, their mechanical limbs twitching across spools of parchment. More parchment lay in heaps and drifts, every inch covered with lines of script. Tables had been overturned at the rear of the vault, and he spied robed adepts crouched behind them fearfully, aiming weapons that had likely not seen use in decades. Among them were half a dozen battle sisters, the hostiles Gurnt had noted. One of the women hefted a heavy bolter. It was braced across one of the overturned tables, and she let it drift with a gunner's grace. Servitors were blown to bits, even as they continued at their labours. One of Apis's warriors staggered, sparks and pressure fluid spilling from his battle plate. The other battle sisters immediately consolidated their fire on him. The warrior fell like a toppled tree and did not move. The bloodletters reached them then. The woman with the heavy bolter kicked back from the table and swung it about. A demon rolled away, screeching. Steam rose from its red flesh. Something about the rounds had hurt it more than he'd expected. Materialized Neverborn could be banished with enough damage, but Amatnim suspected there was something else at play. Some form of blessed ammunition, perhaps. One of the other women, the leader, he thought, turned her weapon on the closest servitor and blew its shriveled brains out.
"Destroy the Ricardas!" she roared. "Grenades!"
"Stop them!" he said.
Targeting runes settled over a scribe's pale, frightened features, and he fired, reducing the man's head to a red mist. Apis and the others followed suit as the bloodletters rampaged among the defenders. A few grenades made it, and explosive fragments peppered Abatnim's armour, but the majority of the servitors continued their work, uncomprehending and unaware of the battle going on around them. It was over in moments, though it seemed to take much longer. The battle sisters died standing, demon blades cutting them down, even as Boltafire chewed their frames. The scribes were next, and the bloodletters howled as they collected skulls with savage abandon. Soon, only the woman he'd identified as the leader remained. She took cover behind the servitor plinths, using them to make her way towards one of the alcoves that studded the far wall. Whatever she was going for, Amatnim knew he couldn't allow her to reach it. He paced swiftly after her. Right on her heels, he reached for her. But at the sound of a sharp click, he jerked back. The woman spun, her fist aflame. He avoided the blow, but she continued to move. Her knee caught him in the side, and he stumbled, off balance. The burning fist cracked across the side of his helm, and the heat caused his display to flicker. He drew his axe rake and swept it out, driving her back, knocking the crackling power maul from her hand. She was fast, her power armor lending her speed, but he was faster. He landed a blow that tore a ragged hole in her armor and the meat within. She staggered, somehow still on her feet, backing towards the alcoves. Blood stained her mouth and chin as she bared her teeth. He circled her, getting between the wall and her. She lurched forward, burning fist raised. He caught the blow, felt the heat envelop his hand and forearm. He chopped his blade into her side and pulled, wrenching her augmetic arm from the shoulder housing in a flurry of sparks. She screamed then, a gasping, gurgling cry, and he sent her tumbling away with a twitch of his blade. He studied the burning hand for a moment and then tossed the artificial limb over his shoulder.
"You fought well, but the end was never in doubt."
She fumbled at the ground, trying to rise. A quick diagnostic scan showed major internal injuries, broken bones and ongoing blood loss. She would be dead in moments. Demons crept close, splintered fangs bared in eagerness. Red, raw things, their muscles moved like pistons beneath crimson flesh. They scraped their brass blades across the walls and floor as they circled her, tasting her blood on the air. One, unable to contain itself, darted forward. Amatnim caught it by the horn as it lunged past him and gave it a sharp jerk, snapping whatever passed for its neck. The body dissolved like molten metal. The other Neverborn drew back, snarling in frustration.
"There was no need for that,"
Lacamhue said disapprovingly.
"Keep them under control, and I won't have to do it again."
"Let them have her. What does it matter?"
"Keep them back until I say otherwise. I wish to speak to her."
Amatnim dropped to his haunches beside the woman.
"They will have you before you die, if I let them. Indeed, they will make the moment of your death stretch for hours before they lose their hold on the Materium. Do you understand me?"
She shook her head, coughing. Blood splattered the stones. He tried again.
"You are strong. I can help you. I will help you. Simply ask, and I will keep them from you. I will give you that much, if you but ask."
He could not be certain she understood him. Pain had dulled her mind to animal simplicity. She tried to crawl away, her body barely responding. It was only when he caught sight of the bolt pistol laying half-hidden beneath a fallen servitor that he understood. He reached out, caught the weapon with the hook of his axe rake, and dragged it towards her. She caught it with a groan, and the gathered demons hissed in pleasure. She slumped and rolled, painfully, slowly, until she could aim the weapon at him. Amatnim did not move. He crouched and waited. She pulled the trigger. There was a loud chunk. The bolt pistol was empty. He smiled.
The gods yet have need of me, it seems. But your part in this has come to an end, I fear.
She fell back, breathing in short, ragged gasps. The demons leaned close, eyeing him warily. They hungered for her soul. He removed his helm and set it aside as he hunkered over her.
Ask, and I will give you peace, he whispered into her ear. Just ask.
She spat in his face. He sat back and wiped her blood from his cheek. She gave a rattling sigh and went limp. He crouched for a moment longer, giving her soul the time it needed to depart. Then he rose, rubbing her blood between his fingers. He looked at the Neverborn. One of the creatures rose on its hooves, its angular, narrow body stretching as it thrust its skeletal features close to his own. It spoke, in a voice like stones rolling through broken glass. The words slipped from his mind the moment he heard them, but he understood regardless. The others rose as well, converging on him. He smiled. My apologies, but she was mine. My kill.
There are other souls in this place. Have them, if you would.
His smile faded.
But this one was mine.
He held the demon's gaze for long moments. It gave a contemptuous snort and turned away, dragging its blade along the ground. The others followed it as it loped away, out of the vault, seeking new prey.
You take chances, my lord,
Appis said from behind him. The gods love a gambler.
Amatnim looked down at the dead woman.
She was strong. Mad, but strong. It is a shame that they are blind to the glories of the primordial truth. 100 of them would be the equal of 1,000 cultists.
They say some have come to know the truth. Only a few, though.
Appis drew a combat knife from his belt.
I will add her skull to the pyramid.
Amatnim gestured.
No. Leave it where it is. We have plenty for the pyramids. If Khorne wishes this one in particular, he may collect it himself.
He turned and looked at the alcoves. What was she after? Lacimhue gestured with his crosiers.
Likely the controls to those flamer jets set into the ceiling. I think she meant to incinerate this vault and everything in it.
He joined Amatnim and looked down at the body.
You should have let the Neverborn have her.
He glanced around.
This is why you blazed a path through this system. Parchment. The tattered philosophies of a dying regime.